This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Garrett Venneklausen. He's Executive Director of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and Todd Leahy, who is the Conservation Director there. And we are here to talk about the ongoing situation up at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you. It's a really important topic to talk about. As many of our listeners know, on January 2nd, a group of armed men, I think mostly men, took over a federal bird refuge near Burns, Oregon. What did they want? What is your understanding of this situation?
I mean, I think one of the reasons that we went to Malheur in the first place was to try and make sense of all this and to try and meet some of them and talk to some of them to see if there really was any sort of legitimacy to what they're doing. And the reality of what the media is portraying and the reality of who they are and what they're doing are so different. And I think almost 2 weeks after our visit there, I think we're both trying to process. It was so strange and so surreal, the whole experience, and so odd.
Well, why don't you talk about why you decided to go and what your experience was like?
Well, first of all, I mean, we were having our public lands rally at the state capitol. And the whole idea of public lands transfer and this whole movement is somewhat, or has been somewhat, esoteric.
Now, the idea, I mean, when we talk about what these people supposedly want, is to be able to use federal land as they see fit and not have it be federally regulated. Is that a fair interpretation?
That's part of what they want, yes. And that's a fair interpretation of part of what they want. I mean, these guys are anti-government sort of on all fronts. And so they would like to see all government regulations sort of go away and have this land opened up to whomever. They say the people of the county or the area right there around the refuge. But I think they'd open it up to anybody.
And the interesting thing is that they're pretending to speak on behalf of the local community, on behalf of the county commissioners, on behalf of the sheriff, on behalf of the city councilors of Burns. But they're not. They've been denounced. Even the ranchers have denounced them locally. So they're not speaking on behalf of any locals at all.
And they're not from there.
No.
Correct.
Eamon Bundy's from Phoenix, and he owns a trucking company. He's not even a rancher himself. And so it's all a charade. It's all a very clever charade.
Let's step back for a moment. Ammon Bundy is the son of Cliven Bundy, who was a rancher who refused to pay his grazing fees. And the federal government went after him, and there was another standoff. Mm-hmm. And he basically got away with it.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about this background?
That was pretty much it. Cliven Bundy was ranching on federal land for roughly 20 years without paying any grazing fees, to the tune of somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million or more in back fees. And when the federal government tried to come in and enforce those leases, he refused to pay, and armed militia showed up to defend him. And this is part of the problem. These ranchers have been allowed to use this land almost unobstructed for so long that in many families, they talk about it as if it's theirs, and it's not their land. It's theirs to use. They have the right to use it, but they don't own it. They can't do whatever they want with it. And that's really the catalyst for what happened in Oregon as well, was ranchers sort of treating federal land as if it was their own.
But interestingly enough, not the local ranchers. And I think it's also important to note that there's so many great people in the ranching community.
Absolutely.
That are great stewards. They're law-abiding people. They're inclusive in their conversation. They don't want to abuse the land. They want the land to be in its best state. And so it's so tragic in my mind for people like these Bundy folks to take the air out of the room and speak on behalf of the ranching community, who is by and large very responsible and really want to be good stewards.
There are real questions about stewardship, which I want to talk about in a moment, because, I mean, you, Todd, are conservation director for the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and it's not just a matter of whether somebody's ranching it or not, but it's how they're ranching
it. Exactly.
And the question of how Cliven Bundy ranched his land, I mean, he owed $1 million worth of grazing fees. And how much money did he make? How did he leave the land? I mean, those are questions that I think should be more part of this discussion.
For sure. And I think, just to interject real quickly, Todd, I think we have to also remember that grazing fees on BLM and the U.S. Forest Service are subsidized. And so they have a calf-cow, AUM they call it. It's a monthly fee for a calf-cow pair, $1.38. It was, and it's just been raised very slightly. Fair market value for private land grazing, $13 to $40 an AUM. And yeah. So this is a very heavily subsidized fee. And we have seen people like Cliven who are very abusive and who have grazed big landscapes down to the bedrock and have really compromised watersheds. You know, across the West, we've seen this sort of abuse. Again, it's not necessarily the standard or the norm, but we have seen very entitled permittees who have really been destructive and are not just destroying wildlife habitat, but actually watershed dynamics. And I think that every New Mexican and every citizen should be very concerned about watershed integrity.
Now, when you talk about the relationship between ranching and watershed integrity, what are we talking about?
Well, just like you or I would, if we were out on the landscape for days on end, the cattle tend to hang out in the riparian areas right next to the streams and the creeks and things. And so all their grazing is there. All of their function is right there in that riparian area. And it has a tendency to destroy and degrade those critical riparian habitats. And then that, of course, washes everything downstream, and it has that downstream effect.
And so when we talk about watershed, we're talking about actually ruining streams and rivers.
Well, and not just the stream and river, but the functionality of the stream and river. I mean, when you start incising banks of a river, for example, and you start degrading the vegetation that holds the whole system together, what ultimately happens is you destroy the water table and the functionality of the water system itself. And so in the spring, instead of a very slow release and retention of water in sort of a subterranean reservoir, what happens is you create a channel of water to run off. And so the entire system fails. And so it's really horrible and bad. And we see that in many, many places still in the West.
I saw a really awesome demonstration of that once where a high school girl had come up with, here's what happens with land that has not been treated well. Water runs right off it. Here's land that has been treated well. It acts more like a sponge. And she took a piece of bread and a pile of flour and poured water on each one.
That's it.
And the bread
absorbed
the water and the flour just ran all over the place.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. And cattle have that effect because not only do they graze on that riparian vegetation, but they're also tramping it down, and they channel out the stream, and they have a deleterious effect on a riparian area.
And again, there's some really great public lands grazers. The permittee up in Valle Vidal, for example, Torres is his last name. He's voluntarily taken his cows off that riparian area that they're restoring, Trout Unlimited and the Covera Coalition. He's taken his cows off of that landscape voluntarily so that the riparian area will heal itself. And he's also moving, he's got a cowboy on that allotment to keep those cows out of the riparian area. So there's some really great examples of permittees that are doing an amazing job with stewarding their allotments.
And there's also people who are doing what's called rotational grazing and moving cows from one place to another so that they can't really stay in any one place for all that long.
Right, right. And I think this is really where the conversation needs to go. I mean, we all need to come together and have a proactive common ground dialogue about our land management challenges and take everyone to the table instead of being reactive and polarizing and violent. We're a community, right? And we have lots of different interests, but we do have common values and can find some really sensical, pragmatic solutions to some of the grievances that some of the people, the sensible people in the ranching community, actually have.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point to make. I haven't met anyone involved in this conversation in any way who says, oh, the federal grazing system or land management system's fantastic, love it, don't change it. Everybody's got their issues and their problems. It's the way that you solve them that we're having the problem with now.
Right. Yeah. Do you solve them by going in with guns and beating your chest?
Well, and I'm a gun owner. I have an arsenal of guns, but do you see me getting in people's faces with my guns? I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, I think one of the things that is disturbing about this is the precedent that this is setting. And actually, the precedent was set with Ammon Bundy's father, Cliven Bundy, who got a bunch of so-called and misnomered militias to basically say, do you want to have a bloodbath or can we have our way?
Right. And it's so anti-American that the irony of it is, I mean, we're a community of diverse interests and diverse voices, and they are totally exclusive. They're saying, we want it for ours, me, mine, ours. But there's so many different interests that need to be part of this conversation. And it's anti-community. It's anti-democracy. It flies against the tenets of the republic, which are based on law.
Yeah.
It's absolute hypocrisy, and they're using sound bites and bits of the Constitution and words like patriotism to confuse and manipulate people. And we met some pretty good-hearted people that were foot soldiers who had been manipulated by these sound bites. And when you started to have a more sort of a deeper conversation, I think even some of their foot soldiers began to question why they were there and what they were doing. It was really odd.
We're talking to Garrett Vanniclausen and Todd Leahy of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. Let's talk for a moment about the constitutional issues that are involved here. There is some quoting. It's sort of like, it reminds me a little bit of cherry picking the Bible. Like you take this one verse out, right. And they're taking out this one section of the Constitution, which it turns out actually applies to the District of Columbia. Explain this to us.
What they're pulling out is called the Enclave Clause. It's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Talk to any of those folks long enough and you will have this repeated to you over and over and over. What the clause says is that the federal government, in establishing a national capital, not to exceed 10 square miles, can own this land as federal land. The way that that group of folks is interpreting that little clause in the Constitution is that not to exceed 10 square miles means that the federal government can own no more than 10 square miles. If you read it in the context of the rest of the Constitution, and the reason it's called the Enclave Clause, is because it carves out this small little section to create a national capital. That national capital shall not exceed 10 square miles. So the limit is on the size of Washington, D.C., not the amount of land the federal government can own. And I think there's no better example for this than the Louisiana Purchase. 1803, Thomas Jefferson doubles the size of the United States. The federal government purchases from France the entire territory of Louisiana. That becomes federal property. Are we going to debate the founding father credibility of Thomas Jefferson? I'm not. So we have this long history of the federal government owning land. So to cite this one clause, and it's interesting that you used sort of cherry picking the Bible, because that's the same analogy that I always use. It's you can read that section of the Constitution the way they want if you take it entirely out of context and strip it entirely out of the history of the Republic. But when you put all that context in there, then that clause has its real meaning. Then that is that the federal government owns and manages Washington, D.C., which shall not exceed more than 10 square miles.
Now, there are other parts of the Constitution that do apply to ownership of property that are relevant here.
There are other sections of the Constitution that speak to the ownership of property, but none of them limit the federal government in a way that these individuals and those believing like them feel. In fact, these lands, again, that are current federal lands, were at one time open for settlement. You know, under the Homestead Act and the Morrill Land Grant right there around the time of the Civil War, these lands were open. The reason they are still in federal possession is because settlers didn't want them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, one of the things that's happening in response to this whole business in Oregon is that some Native American groups are saying, hey, guys, who was really here first?
Well, when we drill down to, you know, these comments of our land and my land and whose land is it? I mean, situations like in Oregon, the Burns Paiute tribe, that's their land. I mean, they were there. You know, if you want to talk about sort of a historical claim to ownership, and that's one of the claims that these guys make. Well, before the wildlife refuge, we used this to blah, blah, blah. So a historical claim to ownership. The Burns Paiute have been there for, you know, 6,000 years at least. It doesn't get much more historically valid than that.
And this was so weird. I mean, since Todd and I returned from Oregon, we've been getting a lot of hate mail from these guys because we hijacked their press conference. And
this we got to hear about.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. But one of the most sort of noteworthy pieces of hate mail that I received was, "Dear Mr. Venneklaassen, your last name is not an American name. Get the blobbity blop out of my country." And he wasn't thinking about American names like Begay and all the other Native American names.
Right.
He was thinking about names like Jones and Smith.
That are English names.
Right, yes. Right. And it was just so, this is the mindset. This is the, and they're so racist and so exclusive. And it's such a tragedy to see the Paiutes thrown under the bus in the conversation. That was so great about our public lands rally, is really the most noteworthy and powerful speakers at our public lands rally were the tribes. And I mean, they need to be front and center in this conversation. And they're really taking ownership of this nationally, which is really exciting.
So let's go back to your trip. I mean, here you are with the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and I want to talk more with you guys about what your organization does. But tell us about, okay, you decided to go see for yourselves what was going on there in Oregon.
Right. And
you got in your car.
Yeah, there was two reasons. One, we wanted to do a short video to engage people because public land seizure, it's gone from public lands transfer now to public land seizure. The other reason, because Todd and I are shareholders in this land in Oregon.
As we all are.
As we all are. Yeah. And we wanted to go there and take a stand and say, hey, we're from another state, but proximity does not bestow any privilege to you there. And that was the other irony, is that here we have the Amon boys and their group. Most of those people are out-of-state people, speaking on behalf of the locals, saying that it should have local control. So the hypocrisy was like Little Rascals Clubhouse on acid. It was so weird. It was all so weird.
So, I mean, but walk us through it. You get in your car, you drive to Oregon.
It was surreal. So we land in Boise and we have a very long trip. It's a 3-hour drive from Boise.
Oh, so you flew up there. Okay.
Yeah. We drove from Boise to Burns. And it was fogged in, and we got up in the morning and had a very surreal experience in the Days Inn. And then right at daybreak, we drove to the refuge, which is right outside of Burns, and it was fogged in, and you couldn't see more than about 25 feet. And we came down this frosted road, and out of the fog emerges this guy on a beautiful horse with a big old pistol on his hip and an American flag standing in the road. And from there on out, it was just so surreal. And, you know, we get out of the car. We don't know if they're going to shoot at us or run us off.
Now, you're somebody who, I think, as you said, if you put on a cowboy hat, you would blend right in with the guys. I mean, you could be mistaken for Ammon Bundy.
I can transform. I can channel Ammon pretty well, I think. Yeah. So, and it was so weird. I mean, he wanted to know what we were doing there. When then we started to have a conversation, and he was like, "Hey, neighbor, you know, let's."
He offered us coffee.
It was so weird. I mean,
that
weird. Was
the welcoming that we got was, you know, this incredibly intimidating picture that Garrett just described of the man on horseback and, you know, a roadblock of the Wild West sort of vintage. And then he says, "It's pretty cold today. Y'all need some coffee?"
And he's like, "You're welcome here." And I said, "Hey, I don't feel welcome here." I said, "Somebody with a pistol on their hip, that doesn't make me feel warm and fuzzy." And he's like, "Well, it's not you that we're not welcoming, it's the feds." And I was like, "Hey, you know, I am part of We the People."
Yeah.
And so he started to get confused, and he was like, "You know, I'm just a soldier here. You need to talk to the men in charge." And it was like,
basically he took no responsibility for kind of thinking it through.
No, not at all. Right. He admitted to that instantly. Mm-hmm. And then of course the men in charge were, I think someone had described them as outpatients at one point, but they were all odd.
So what did you do? So you went with this guy on
horse? Well, we parked our car there. That was at the headquarters.
So you were at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge?
Yeah, right
in the visitor's parking area.
Yeah, which is sort of right down the little trail is their headquarters that they've taken over. And there was a truck parked there that had there was a professional stencil job that said, if you were born after 1980, you have a microchip in your head. These are the type of people that have taken over the refuge. We're talking about Agenda 21, which is this conspiracy theory. They're conspiracy theorists, really a ragtag band of outliners. And it just got more and more strange after that. And then suddenly Ammon, who was apparently staying in town at the Days Inn or wherever he was staying, warm and cozy.
So he's not even staying out there.
He's coming and going in Burns, you know, eating big fat meals, and it's so weird. And so he rolls up with what's his sidekick?
Lavoie Finicum,
it's a charade. I mean, again, Ammon, he owns a trucking company. He went and bought a hat at Boot Barn and put this hat on and pretends to be a rancher. And it's all a charade. It's all a parody. And he rolls up with Lavoie to do this press conference.
Now, where's the press conference?
It's right in the parking lot in this frozen, foggy wasteland of beautiful country.
Yeah.
And so they're having this press conference. And again,
and the press is there.
Everyone's there. CNN and New York Times and NBC and ABC. There was 50 or 60 press there. And of course, Ammon does his constitutional song and dance and, you know, I'm a patriot and all that stuff. And he turns away from the microphone and I'm standing there with Todd. And I said, "Todd, shouldn't I just step up to the microphone and see what happens? Because we have a very different opinion." And once I got to the microphone, they couldn't really do anything. I mean, what are they going to tackle me in front of the national press group?
And so what'd you say?
I said, "I came from New Mexico. This is our land. This is my daughter's land." I said, "I came here from New Mexico to tell you to get the hell off our land." And I mean, it was the right thing to do.
Now, did you say anything besides that?
I said lots of things. I said, "We need to change the conversation." Yeah. I said, "We need to take insanity out of the conversation and come together as a community and have some common sense dialogue, sensical dialogue. I mean, if we have issues with land management, we don't solve them with guns. We're a law-abiding citizenry that believes in a republic based and built on law." There was a lot of things that were really important to say. And we were some of the first people to actually change the conversation, because until then the Bundys and their gang had a singular voice, and it was really being misinterpreted by the media. They were this downtrodden group of people that had been taken advantage of. And again, it's all about hypocrisy. They're trying to take advantage.
And the story is constantly related to the story of the Hammond family. And the Hammond family were local ranchers who had a run-in with the law because of some arson. They had lit a backfire.
And poached some deer.
And they had poached some deer. And they had lit a backfire to do two things, apparently, allegedly, cover up the evidence of the poaching and to stop a spreading fire. And when Bundy came out to give his press conference, and when you hear these guys talk, is they'll talk about how they're representing the Hammond family.
Now, the Hammond family was convicted, and their sentences were appealed as being too short because of federal sentencing guidelines, and so then they were sent to jail to prison for the longer sentences.
Right, whole separate issue there. They serve a year in prison, and they're let go, but the federal mandatory minimum is a 5-year sentence. But to the Hammonds' credit, and I think we have to give credit where it's due, they were fined $400,000. They paid it. They served 1 year in prison, were resentenced to 4 more under the federal mandatory minimum sentencing requirements. They surrendered and went to prison. And they have asked Amon Bundy and the men with him to leave and have publicly stated that they don't speak for them. Mm. That doesn't stop these guys.
Yep.
How many people need to say no? When we were there right after the press conference, as Garrett's dealing with, you know, the press on his own, Bundy has this caravan. They go down and they cut the fence and let a local rancher bring his cattle onto the wildlife refuge. What does the local rancher do the next morning? He rebuilds the fence and he right. refuses to take his cattle onto the refuge.
Right.
These are good people, not represented by Bundy and his compatriots there.
Yep.
We're talking to Todd Leahy and Garrett Venneklausen of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation about the standoff, as it's being called, at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. Now, one of the things that also hasn't really been talked about that much is what crimes these guys in Oregon are guilty of. Do we have a sense of that? I mean, if one were to follow the letter of the law and arrest people for whatever it is that they've done so far, what would that be?
And I'm going to start with one, and I'd love Todd to go here, but they desecrated archaeological sites of the Paiutes with a bulldozer. Let's start there.
Yeah, so what was that? 2 days ago, I believe? 2-3 days ago, they created a road through the wildlife refuge. They just took a bulldozer and basically rode across the middle of the refuge and made a road. And they destroyed some artifact deposits from the Paiute tribe that, again, are somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 years old. And they have a video of themselves with these artifacts in a box inside the headquarters of the wildlife refuge. And they're just kind of digging through them saying, well, we want to return these to the Paiute tribe. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, in that worldview of those native folks, you know, those things belong where they were, you know, not in a box and not returned to them. They belong where they were and in peace. So right there, we've got violations of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. We've got a violation of the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. We've got theft of government property, simple theft of government property. That's a government bulldozer that they used. They didn't bring that in from Amon Bundy's trucking company. You know, right. that was there.
Vandalism of federal property.
Yeah. I mean,
assault on federal employees, armed assault on federal employees.
Well, the occupation itself. I mean, I couldn't go downtown to the federal courthouse with guns and tell everybody get out of here and then start ordering takeout and vanilla creamer.
Right. And imagine, I think the other thing, really important thing is, I mean, these are very white men with this sort of cowboy persona. Imagine if these were brown-skinned people that were doing the same thing. What do you think would have happened then? How quickly would this have been squashed if these people were of different ethnic background?
Well, right. But that brings up the question is, I mean, we know that law enforcement is often unnecessarily violent toward Black and brown people in the United mm-hmm. States, and that's not right. So that's not necessarily the standard for the right response, right? So what is the right response? I mean, these guys are occupying federal property with guns.
And it's domestic terrorism is what it is.
That's what I'm asking. Does it fit the definitions of domestic terrorism?
Absolutely.
It fits the legal definition of something called seditious conspiracy. And seditious conspiracy is, I mean, almost this to a T. This is the example you would use if you were a law school professor. That a group of people take up arms and occupy a federal establishment and threaten federal employees at gunpoint. You know, I don't have an exact citation to the U.S. Code, but it's the definition. It's the picture perfect definition of seditious conspiracy.
If two or more persons in any state or territory or in any place subject to the jurisdiction of the United States conspired to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government of the United States or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority thereof, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States contrary to the authority thereof, they shall each be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both.
There we go.
That's it.
That's it. And that's just one of the offenses.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys should go to jail. Do not pass go.
But meanwhile, the three of us and all of our listeners are paying their utility bills
exactly.
in the refuge.
Exactly. Exactly. It's wild. And I think it's an important part of the conversation. And I do think it's important that these people aren't martyred and we don't have another Waco. But there has to be a point where you cut the power off, you close the roads off, and they have to take a stand here because this has come to New Mexico. They're planning another seizure in Utah. So this is a disease that is turning into an epidemic. And the implications of this on a national level are profound.
And not to sound flippant, but if you could routinely violate handfuls of federal law and get away with it without any consequence at all,
right?
Why wouldn't you plan another siege? Why right. wouldn't yeah. you try to right. export what you were doing?
Right, and let's go home and rip up our mortgages. Let's go home and, you know, what are the implications
rip
of this?
Rip up our student loans.
Right, exactly.
Please, I mean, can we do that?
Right. Where do we stop? And so this is so much bigger than just the specifics of this one issue. Yeah.
So here's the thing that I think is important to talk about. So we have in New Mexico just a day or two ago, a rancher here in New Mexico said that on the basis of what they're doing, he has decided not to honor his grazing fees right. for the federal land that he is using on which to graze his cattle. Now, this is the direction that we're going. More federal seizures, more lawlessness, right. more, as you put it, white guys with guns who are essentially anarchists, who don't believe in the rule of law, who believe they should be able to do whatever they want. What is the right conversation to be having? I mean, we're talking about public lands in which there are a lot of interests. There are people who want to drill every last inch of public mm-hmm. lands for oil, gas, and whatever minerals are underneath them. There are people who want to have no cattle anywhere on public lands ever because of the history of overgrazing and the damage that's been done. Or there's radical vegans who don't think that anybody should eat any meat either. There are people who want lands for recreation, right. that it should be all camping and hiking. Then there's mm-hmm. you guys hunting and fishing. There's so many different interests mm-hmm. from business to recreation and everything in between. What's the way to have the conversation on how to manage public lands? What are we doing well right now? What could we be doing better?
Well, here's some really good examples. So, you know, Taos County, for example, they have this Taos Valley Watershed Coalition, and it is made up of cattle permittees, state foresters, neighborhoods, county, sportsmen, recreational community members, acequia parciantes, land grant heirs, and all these people with all these diverse interests have come together to form a coalition to address landscape and watershed restoration on national public lands. Everybody, Forest Service is at the table, BLM is at the table, everyone is at the table having a really good conversation about how we proactively solve these land management challenges so that we can move forward. So that is how we do this. We take reactionaries and ideologues and radicals out of the conversation And we proactively, respectfully, through dialogue, because we're all community members, right? We're all neighbors. We all respect each other. We may have differing opinions, but at the end of the day, this is about our kids. So we move away from these crazy reactionary folks, and we have a really common ground, sensible dialogue with all the stakeholders at the table. It's already happening in places like Taos. That's where we go with this.
What are some examples of land management where the outcomes have been really well balanced in your view?
Well, just here in Santa Fe, our watershed restoration project is really fantastic. In the Santa Fe watershed, there's been some really proactive, aggressive restoration on the ground implementation, which has been great for wildlife and for watershed, and ultimately can be great for the cattle permittees because we're creating a lot more upland grass and thinning our forest by doing so. If you move over into the Jemez, the collaborative restoration project there, which was an $80 million federal appropriation for forest restoration and thinning, massive 110,000-acre, very collaborative restoration process going on over in the Jemez, helping ranchers, helping cattle, helping wildlife, helping the recreational community, creating opportunity, being proactive. This is going on all around us, and can and should be going on all across the West if we just stop this sort of reactionary, polarizing, violent, oftentimes. They're taking the air out of the room of a great conversation and a great process that's already happening.
I think also it's important to talk about the fact that if you really take that point of view, like the government shouldn't have any say on what happens on federal lands or on public lands, if you take that to its logical extreme, then ExxonMobil could come in with tanks and bulldoze the lands of these people who are grazing cattle right now.
And that's the interest. That's a great point because, I mean, these guys are saying, you know, we want to give the land to the state. And of course, the state can't afford to manage it. I mean, look at...
They can't afford to fight fires.
No, Las Conchas cost $240 million to fight. The cleanup costs for land, for mining, waste mine sites like up in Red River, $21 billion across the West. States can't afford to manage these lands. So what do? They sell these lands off to the highest bidder. Well, do you think that highest bidder is going to be a rancher? No, it's going to be Chinese, Saudi. It's going to be
oil interests or the dollar store.
Absolutely. And these are the people that are behind this whole movement. The American Lands Council, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Koch Brothers, ExxonMobil. I mean, Google the American Legislative Exchange Council and look at who is the puppeteer of Ayman Bundy and his folks. Big moneyed interests that want our resources, the most precious of which is water and watersheds, because you control water in the West and you control the watershed in the West. You're the king of the world.
This alliance of big money and essentially big corporate money with people who fancy themselves to be the kind of self-sufficient, independent cowboy of the West archetype is kind of crazy. And it says, I mean, those extremes are as far apart as you can get.
Well, and I think that's so relevant in New Mexico because we have such a history of culture and sustainability and land use between our tribal cultures and our Spanish culture. Again, those cultures have been hammered and formed by the land and from the land. And so maintaining the integrity of the land and the availability of those cultures to utilize these big landscapes is so, so important. And so if we sell these lands or transfer them to the state and then privatize them, we will kill our culture. Because if you can't enact your cultural values on a landscape, you lose those values in a single generation.
Now, what's in it for the Ayman Bundys of this world to be collaborating with the Koch brothers of this world? I mean, are they aware that of that connection themselves?
Yeah, I don't know. have any access to Ammon Bundy's checking account. I don't think the Koch brothers are writing him checks. It just happens that the interests align and that the Koch brothers can put their money and use this for their spin. I mean, the arguments of, you know, the Bundy and his dad, that, you know, they came out of the Sagebrush Rebellion of the 70s. There are some legitimate complaints there for some of these folks, but again, you know, this isn't the way we handle it. This isn't even the way the Koch brothers handle it.
But it's interesting, the rhetoric that we heard coming out of the people at Malheur is the exact same rhetoric that we hear coming out of Commissioner Aubrey Dunn's mouth. The exact same rhetoric that
Land
comes
Commissioner
out
of New Mexico.
Yeah, the exact same rhetoric that comes out of Representative Yvette Harrell's mouth from Otero County. The exact same rhetoric that comes out of Congressman Steve Pierce. The exact same rhetoric. It's all the same message and the same, you know, it's the same stuff. And so there's a real connection. And supposedly, over the weekend, New Mexican state legislators went out to meet with Ammon Bundy in Oregon, and we're still trying to figure this out. It's just, they're all connected and they're all working together in some way or another. It's not coincidental. So this isn't about the downtrodden man who's working the landscape and is being done wrong. This is much bigger and more complicated than this.
And I think we're kind of past the era where left and right fit into understandable categories.
Exactly.
Where liberal and conservative fit into understandable categories that face off against one another. Right. I mean, I think that hardcore conservationists have far more in common, and who are very much liberal Democrats or progressive Democrats, have far more in common with conservation ranchers.
Totally. And the roots of conservation come out of the conservative party. Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican. And so, I mean, that's another irony, is that the Republican Party, their platform is public lands transfer, but their core tenets were the creation of public lands. And so there's so much weirdness and hypocrisy. And then we have Donald Trump, who has recently come out in support of public lands. And he's kind of turned the Republican Party on end, because his message is completely different than the platform of the party. And, you know, we called Governor Martinez out at the public lands rally saying, Governor Martinez, why are you not here with the tribes? And we had the Gonzalez boys, these eighth or 10th generation kids their family has been using the land forever before New Mexico was a state or the United States existed. Why was the governor not there supporting this? You know, it's just odd. It's really odd.
What are you, as an organization, calling on Americans, on American citizens to do? I mean, how have you responded to this? Yeah, you went to Oregon. You're part of an organization, but what is our role? What is ordinary people's role who maybe don't believe in the kind of anarchic, you know, might makes right activity that's going on up there?
I think it's really simple. I think it's a local and national call to action that we have to demand that all of our elected officials, from city council members, county commissioners, legislators, our governors, our congressional delegates, that they denounce this thing vociferously and publicly and force the conversation away from this radical, polarizing one to a one of dialogue and inclusion and collaboration. And we have to demand that. I sent Governor Martinez a letter inviting her to join us in a rally. Never even came out during this huge rally that we had. We still, today in committee, Representative Candy Azell championed the Bundys today at the Roundhouse. We have to demand that they stop that. What is the point?
What do you think law enforcement should do?
I mean, I was asked that same question at Malheur by the press. I think that the local law enforcement should probably take this on so that there isn't some sort of strange perception that the quote unquote federal government, which is really we the people, right? I think that the sheriff should, if he and his team of local law enforcement have the capability to arrest these people, that they should take the lead on this so that there is some local law.
But it is a set of federal crimes committed on federal land.
Well, and they should work collaboratively to address this thing. But the sheriff should definitely have a very important role in this, and that the federal government and the local law officials should work in a very collaborative way to put a swift and decisive end to this.
We're talking to Garrett Venneklausen and Todd Leahy of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and we've got just a few minutes left. Tell us a little more about the federation, the people you guys represent, and some of the accomplishments that you've had here in New Mexico.
So we were formed in 1914 by Aldo Leopold, who was one of the great sort of grandfathers of sort of the conservation movement. In 1914, Western landscapes had been ravaged by cattle and logging, and there was no regulation at all, mining.
And the regulation we had, like the Homestead Act, was really ill-conceived.
Right. And you know, there was 14 antelope in the entire state in 1914. Elk had been completely exterminated from the state. There was, I think, 6 deer harvested in the entire northern New Mexico in 1914. There was no wildlife left. And so Aldo Leopold came onto this landscape, and he was just a really visionary, passionate guy. And he, I don't know if you've read Sand County Almanac, but it's a beautiful book. And this was this visionary guy who said, we just need some sideboards, some common sense sideboards to how we manage these precious resources. And again, his whole thing was water and watershed and the integrity of landscapes and watersheds. And I think that's where that's sort of our core tenets, is just pragmatic, science-based management of wildlife and watersheds.
Now, you have a focus on hunting and fishing, but is that most of your constituency or not so much?
No, and our focus really isn't. I mean, sportsmen and women are a large part of our membership, but we have lots and lots of members that are just people that love the outdoors and who love wildlife. And the great thing about Leopold was that he was a hunter and a fisherman, but he was also a botanist and a mycologist and a forester and just a lover of wild things and wild places. And he was the one who formed our first wilderness in the Gila Wilderness long before the Wilderness Act was passed in 1924. One of the things we do is champion conservation of landscapes. We were very instrumental in Rio Grande del Norte and the monument, very instrumental in working with the local community in Oregon Mountains, Desert Peaks, very involved with the Columbine Hondo Wilderness. We're very also involved with the expansion of the Pecos Wilderness. So landscape conservation is really, really an important tenet to us. But we're not just sportsmen and women. And as individuals, we're not sort of your typical, you know, the kind of hayseed that you see on television that's irreverent and shooting animals. And we're not about that. That's not who we are. And so,
well, I think it's important, just as ranchers kind of divide into those who are stewarding the land thoughtfully. I mean, hunters are the same way. There are some hunters who are really aware of habitat, and there are some who are not so much.
Yeah. Right, right. Absolutely. And that's really who we are. We're people and I feed my family with game. I'm not a trophy hunter. I think trophy hunting's kind of a weird thing. But I do love to feed my family delicious, sustainable protein that comes off the land. And I think it's a core traditional land use value. I think who we are as a creature, we evolve by hunting and gathering. And I think we need to reconnect in some way or another with that historical past. And so we're a lot more diverse and complex as a community, and especially as an organization, than some people think we are.
Garrett Venneklausen and Todd Leahy are with the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. They are on the web at nmwildlife.org. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.